You're listening to SaberCast with Rob Dyer, your home for the deepest insights into baseball featuring guests from throughout the game. SaberCast is a production of the Society for American Baseball Research. For more information about Saber and to check out the show page, visit saber.org. Now, here's Rob Dyer.
Welcome to SaberCast. I'm Rob Dyer and am thrilled this week to welcome back to the show Eddie Frierson, the creator of the one-man play, Matty, An Evening with Christy Mathewson. This is actually, when I said return, this is actually part two of our interview. This is the first two-part interview we've ever run on this show, but Eddie was just so fantastic and has so many great stories that we decided to, well, we could have run the whole thing as one very long episode. We could have cut something, or we could have broken it up, and we chose to break it up. So here is part two of my conversation with the delightful Eddie Frierson, in which he talks about finding the dramatic thread in his play. He's got some great stories about pitching batting practice as Christy Mathewson at the Cracker Jack Classic Old Timers game a few decades ago. Fantastic stories about Catfish Hunter, Bob Feller, Joe DiMaggio. He's also got some great news about the future of Matty, maybe even a return to New York. Lots of other good stuff here. Thanks so much to Eddie for joining us. Really enjoyed our conversation. Later, I will be back with a few thoughts about what I have been reading lately. Also, some baseball literature news I wanted to share with you. But first, here again is part two of my conversation with Eddie Frierson. Well, you, I think, realized at one point that, how about this for a segue, Christy Mathewson was a special person. Right. And you mentioned pitching in a pinch and how you were inspired by the stories. But I saw you perform the play in San Francisco in, actually, 98, it was a suburb, but 1998. Yeah. That is correct, yeah. At the Sabre Convention. And your show, I don't think you would have been happy building a show or a performance that was just Christy Mathewson telling baseball stories. Right. You needed an emotional center, and it is a. I found the performance quite moving. There's an emotional center to it, so
I really appreciate it.
An emotional thing. Good. I'm glad. So that emotional center, I don't think it could be drawn from pitching in a pinch. So, and I know this has been, you probably find new things all the time that you're adding either to the text or to your performance of it. But where did you find that emotional center initially that you needed to make it to make it worth doing for all these years?
Well, it's there's always interesting stories in the development of things, and there are certain artistic license points in any theatrical event or whatever, just to sort of make the theme go. But the thing is, it's almost entirely Christy Mathewson's words, so. Mm-hmm. The thing was for me, because all of a sudden there's this influx of, self-therapy, one-person shows that are just boring and horrible and terrible and whatever. To me, it was important that this be something that people who hated sports, who resented their husbands on the weekends watching football, that they would have a terrific theater experience. So I took 9 years developing it. The very first version of it was in 1987, at the Sabre Convention in Crystal City in Washington, D.C. And It was so amateurish, but I knew that. I mean, it literally. So here's the thing. Here's a fun story that I don't think anybody knows. I had just, you know, during the course of that summer of 84 at the Hall of Fame, I filled out the form to be a member of Sabre for like $20 a year. It's like, well, I'll support this because I'm a researcher now. and Sabre was relatively young at the time. And and so I started getting the little newsletters every month, right? And if you remember back then, there was always a names in the news section. Right. And I'm thinking, oh, you know what? Any publicity is good publicity. I can get my name in the news. So I zipped off a letter. Now, at the time, I'm coaching at Santa Monica High. And it's, I don't know, it's probably the end of April, beginning of May. The convention's in June. And I write off a note. Hey, I'm doing a one-man show. It's Christy Mathewson, blah, 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 blah. And I wish I could remember the name of the fellow who was, you could probably find it, who was in charge of, you know, there's it takes a village to create.
There are people listening who have the answer to that
right.
question.
Well, but, you, so, yes. well, but, you know, it, the village that it takes to do anything, much less a convention.
Right.
And I get a call. Hey, Eddie, we got your note, and we'd like to. We're kind of running the idea of maybe centering the convention around lunch with Christy Mathewson. It's like, oh my goodness, what? You know, so it's like I'm on the horn. With my sister Susan. I say, I need a uniform. I need a costume. I need a thing. And then I hadn't even begun to. I hadn't put a single word to paper at that point. And I just started typing, and I'm trying to put together all my notes, and you know, for days I'm just and then I sat down when I had it all kind of done, typos and all, because this is typewriter days, right? This caused me to get my first computer, and I sat down to read it in the morning, and then it's like, oh gosh, I got to go to baseball practice. And I came back, right? It took 12 hours just to read it. And it's like, oh no, I'm in trouble. I've got like 3 weeks and I've got so I'm just pulling out pages, and it's like, what can I do that'll be about 90 minutes of stuff? And I even had, oh gosh, the people who were there were so kind. I put cards out on the table saying, this is the first time this is seeing the light of day. I know it's not great. Please give me any actual criticisms. I don't need to know that it's phenomenal. You know, I'm trying to create a thing with this special guy. And I actually did get a few really wonderful notes. But at that time, you know, I was becoming the characters and doing these scenes. And I even had a ring box. I got a ring box that would go and then picking up a telephone. Hi, John. How you doing, Mac? It was so bad. But because it's a friendly audience, it was good in a way. Right. I know my sister Susan was so sad and upset because towards the end, people were leaving, but it wasn't because it was terrible. It was because they had the next thing to go to because it was a convention, right? And I said, Susan, don't worry about it. It's like, it's a I went too long. This was really bad, you know? So from there, and then it was the next year that I did it at the Santa Monica Playhouse where Tim Leary was involved and all that, and it got all this press. And the next thing you know, I'm being interviewed on ESPN by Roy Firestone as Christy Mathewson, which led to then I was doing another performance of it in the basement of the Santa Monica Public Library. Again, just trying, you know, throwing out this story, putting in this one, mixing up the order, trying to create a theme going all the way through it. And the night of that, which was basically the third time it was ever on its feet, this is going to be the first time I'm going to make it two acts. And that day was the hardest rain other than this hurricane we just had in California, which is a bizarre thing to think. We had a tropical storm hurricane in Los Angeles. it rained so hard that night because it was a full moon, and the way that Venus and the sun and the earth was all put together, it was, I lived on the beach in Santa Monica, and like the waves were crashing on the parking lot. If you've ever been there, it's like a 200 yard long beach. I mean, that's crazy, right? Anyway, so I walk out on stage and there's two of my players, you know, and this was a sellout, right? There's just two of my players. They were identical twins, the Schwengel kids, and their dad is on a spotlight in the back. And the only other two, because I would have just gone, hey, you know, we're just not going to do it tonight. But here's Keith Olbermann and a camera guy from Channel 5 doing the, you know, he was, that was like his first local LA sports gig. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, I got to do it. So I'm editing on the fly. Bing, boom, boom. I do like 35, 40 minutes. Thank you. Good night. And then he pops. They say, hey, do you mind if I, you know, talk to you on the stage for a little bit afterwards? Like, sure. You know, and so we talk, and he's a great guy. You know, we're same age, everything. It's just really a fun thing. And a couple of days later, he calls and says, hey, Eddie, I think you might want to watch the sportscast tonight. So I put together a thing. I think it's kind of fun. And sure enough, it's like, oh, man, this is just cool. That people, even when it, in my opinion, was not any good, thought it was great. That was kind of super. But the thing that happened, where you go back to what your question of theme and how you make it all work. When I was talking with Roy Firestone as Mathewson, he asked a question at the very end. And my answer just off the back of my head turned into, well, you know what? And if you're able to touch just one life in a positive manner, you have succeeded in your own. And so it was just a good line. And he smiled. And I thought, you know what? That's it. That's the through line. Is, you know, and so was able to, you know, so when you talk about artistic license, it was really great. Gabe Schechter years later said, now, hold it. Wait a second. You said that Charlie Faust's dad did the thing. You know, my understanding is Charlie Faust's dad beat him and it was like not a very good relationship. So it's like, well, yeah, OK. that it's all the license stuff. But it's little things that you find out later. There's
right.
But turning that into the end of the Charlie Faust story, because there's other things, too. You know, I take artistic license. Charlie was with them in 1912, 1913. And then he wasn't in 1914 because he was in a sanitarium in Seattle.
Right. I've been to his grave.
Oh, where is it? Is it in Seattle? Where is it?
I want to say it's in Shoreline, but it's a Seattle suburb, just south of Seattle, just north of Tacoma. See, and about 6 years ago, I went to find his grave, which was at that point very difficult to find. I think they've added a marker since then.
That would have been very fun for me to know. You know, I did the show ages ago at Seattle Pacific one night, and that would have been fun to do when I was up there doing that. But anyway, they all thought he was crazy. And he was, but, you know, in that savantish, you know, goofy way. And so in a way, he was with them in 1912 and 1913. But John McGraw had to get restraining orders and different things. You know, they were afraid for their lives because he was so nuts, you know, thinking that, you know, he needed to be a part. But anyway, that ends up being a nice tie together throughout the rest of the play. But other than that artistic license there with the Charlie Faust story, it's pretty much all Christy Mathewson's words. So then it was just a question, well, what order do you put this stuff in? And then how do the transitions work? But when you talk about how things change, not a word of the play had changed since doing it in New York in 1996 until this summer. So my director, Kerrigan Mahan, who is my John McGraw, right? You know, it's like, how in the world are these two guys like the best of friends? Because they're so different, right? But just, I just get him. He gets me. It's a wonderful working collaboration. The second time I did it at the Santa Monica Playhouse, when we go back to Intersound and Bryan Cranston and all that. I'm working on what they call a Walla session. There's like three of us in the studio together, and we're just going to do all the crowd noise and those townspeople in this animated thing. And I'm sitting over in the corner going through my script. And Kerrigan, who's one of these guys? Or you think he is until you get to know him. It's like, what are you looking at? I said, well, I'm doing a show. No, seriously, what are you looking at? I'm going to do the thing at Santa Monica Play. What? I said, well, it's here. He goes, what, you don't know the words yet? That's going to be good. I was like, oh, yeah. He said, when is it? Well, it's this Friday and Saturday night. How much? You don't want to go. It's $20. And at that time, that was a lot for small theater. So anyway, I walk out on the stage, and there he is with a date. And it's like, no way, man. And 2 days later, I get a phone call. It's like, Eddie. Yeah. This guy talked to me. What you have is very special, but you need help. And I went, what? He says, you need a director. I want to direct it. I don't know a thing about baseball, but this guy talked to me. And I went, okay. Well, anyway, so that started the collaboration that created the show as you saw it. This summer, he lives up in Cambria, up by the Hearst Castle now, Central California. And he said that he had gotten booking for 3 nights at the Cambria Performing Arts Center, or the Center for the Arts, Cambria Center for the Arts. And I want to revisit the script. I'm cracking up. He'll laugh when he hears this. You know, I'm kind of cracking up. Like, seriously? It's been 27 years. You want to revisit the script now? And I'm like, okay. So I'm just pacifying him on this phone call in my own mind. Now I'm so glad that I said, yeah, okay, yeah, what? And he goes, so how can we do that? What can we do? I said, well, what's your problem with it? And he says, well, you know, the whole opening is just so fantastic. You know, oh, I was born and I grew up here. And, oh, there's wet paint on a park bench. That's so funny. Ha, ha, ha. Who cares? Where are we? Why are we here? What day is it? And I'm like, so I'm just making it up on the fly. And I go, see, you'll love this when you see it again. I said, well, what if it's October 7th, 1925? And he goes, what's that? I said, well, that's the day he died. Ooh, well, how would we do that? I said, well, you don't want to say it's October 7th. That's like amateur theater. But what if we start at the end? And I'm just making this up, right? And he goes, ooh. I said, so we have this joke. Now, when you saw it in the ballroom, we didn't have all the lighting effects that we could do, but we always called it the tuberculosis, the TB chair light, in the center at the end when I do, you know, get out your whistles and call the overacting police when, you know, you know, I've got tuberculosis, right? Which he always hated, and this kind of solves that problem, too. So I said, well, let's, he's in the TB chair. The show starts, he's in the TB chair. It's like, you know, time, you find tears rolling down. And let's just say, we'll do that. I'll mess with the script a little bit, and I'm thinking I'll just kind of fluff it around. I'll show it to him, and he'll go, nah, that doesn't work. Right. And then the next 2 hours is either the next 3 seconds and he's dying and his life is flashing before his eyes, or he's already dead and this is a reflection and it doesn't matter. But we won't comment on that. Let the audience make up their own mind, blah, blah, blah. And I'm literally making it up. And he's like, I like that. And I'm like, OK, great. So I fiddle around with it. Literally, it made you cry to start the show with all the heavy stuff. You know, my brother Hank is, you know, wasting away before my eyes. There was nothing I could do. And this and the thing and, and then bang, going right into the Fred Merkel story from there. All right. So he said, hey, can you come up a couple of weeks early so that we can rehearse the new stuff? And it's like, sure, because, you know, it's like, because I still thought he was going to say no to the new stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And because it changed the ending, too, because you had to sort of switch it to just do the end, you know, the book end of the start there at the end before the final words of the boys and the questions with the audience, which I don't know if people haven't seen the show. The most fun for me is Christy Mathewson opens it to questions from the audience at the end.
Yes, that's
and
delightful.
At that point mm-hmm. in time, people have totally bought into the fact that I'm Christy Mathewson, which blows my mind. It's just so right. much fun. And even the renowned critic Clive Barnes, who made or broke every show on Broadway for 50 years, first of all, I couldn't believe he came to my show, right? But then secondly, his review of it was unlike any other review he had ever written. It's like, you know, he had never experienced anything like what happened, where the audience really thought they were talking to the guy. And he's afterwards when he talked to me, it's like, oh my gosh, I'm talking to Clive Barnes. He said, you know, I thought, you know, when you started to do that, and it's going to be questions. I said, okay, great. Well, it's a magic show. Where's the shill? Who's going to ask the question? And then not only did you explain the fadeaway, but you explained it in a way to me, who's not a baseball person, could understand how the ball spins, how it does, how it moves, how it does the thing, blah, blah, blah. And I knew that it wasn't a shill because that first question came from my son. So I've never seen anything like it. And I went, well, that's kind of cool. But then what was really fun, too, is like throughout the rest of the 4 months that we were in New York, there were probably four or five reviews where he completely bombed the show, which, you know, you always feel bad for those people. But in each one mm-hmm. of those at the very end, but if you want to go see good theater, go to the Lambs and see Maddie, which I thought was really crazy. So anyway, so here we are. We're trying to do this. And we're rehearsing this, and it just, it's like, how is this not working? But there wasn't enough time. It doesn't mean anything except in theater technical terms, but I'm sitting there. At some point, I got to get the sweater off and on the hat rack and then get into the Fred Merkel story. But here I am in the TV chair, and from the time I don't have enough time to do that where it's not hokey and stupid and why are you even standing up and yada, yada. And he goes, how well do you remember the old way? And of course, I just start reeling it off because it's been in my head for 27 years. And he goes, let's just go back to that. All right. Okay. Great. Well, that night we're at his house and his wife, Melanie, we're all sitting around and talking. And she goes, what do you mean? I read it. It made me cry. I said, yeah, but we worked on it for almost 3 hours and it just doesn't work. And she goes, oh, well, that's too bad, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, we just start talking, da, 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 da. And for some reason, Take Me Out to the Ball Game comes up in the course of conversation. And, you know, me being not just a Sabre geek, but a geek, I said, well, you know how that came about, you know, how the song even happened. So I tell this story of, you know, Jack Norworth and Von Tilzer being, you know, hopping on the subway up at the Polo Grounds. And by the time, you know, the bet was you can't write a song about baseball, the lyrics, until we get to Times Square. And right. And Kerrigan, just his mouth opens up and he goes, that's it. I said, that's what? He goes, that's how we start the show. I went, you're kidding me. He said, yeah, that, but don't finish it. Then do the stuff that makes us cry, then put a button on it with Take Me Out to the Ball Game, then go into September 23rd. I think that'll work. So the next day we go out there and doggone it if it didn't feel great. And the mm-hmm. whole, you know, because they go through the whole story, you know, people don't know who Jack Norworth is, and just basically talking about a vaudevillian and a thing and a blah, 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 blah. And, you know, and they, oh, isn't that a cute story? Oh, he didn't finish the story, you know, and people just forget it. And then it went through the whole thing of, you know, it's sad and tears rolling down my cheeks and blah, blah, blah. And then just finished. Oh, by the way, Jack Norworth won that bet. Take Me Out to the and I start with the Katie Casey. Katie Casey was baseball mad, had the fever and had it bad, just a roof of the hometown crew, every Sue Katie Blue. On a Saturday, her young beau asked to see if she'd like to go to see a show. But Miss Katie said, no, I'll tell you what you can do. You can take me out to the ball game. And the audience just, and you just feel it and you go, what a perfect way to start as a new thing. So we're calling this the 100-year version of the show to honor the 1925 passing of Christy Mathewson. And so it's just kind of, it's so it's fun. If you've seen the show, it's basically the same thing, but you'll think it's different. And it's really just the beginning and the end that's a little bit different. And it's really
well, fun. I saw it so long ago that it would be fresh
there
to me either way. So I would, I am very hopeful.
You know, it's about, when we talk about Saberites, I just did it in Factoryville on Christy Mathewson's mm-hmm. birthday weekend. And R.J. Lesh, who's part of the Dead Ball era, and, you know, he got mm-hmm. me to do the show in Hot Springs, Arkansas years ago. And Perry Barber, who, if you guys don't know, is like one of the great female umpires.
Would you believe, sir, that Perry has been a guest on the show?
I would believe that, because she's well, for years we've been passing notes back and forth, and she's like, I really would love to see the show, blah, 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 blah. Well, she and RJ both drove to see the show in Factoryville, and that was the first time I had met Perry. And then, of course, the fun fact that, you know, when she sent me the picture a couple of days later, she, you know, it's her and RJ, and the caption was, I bet you never thought you'd have two Jeopardy champions in your audience.
So, and you have your own game show experience, which we don't have time
right,
to talk about.
Tic-tac-toe, whatever.
Yes, yeah. I do want to, and you won.
I did. I couldn't beat the dragon, though.
I want to, yeah, the dragon was tough. I want to throw a number at you. I'll leave you with this, or you can leave me with
and
a
we'll
thought.
Have to do this again, because there's more stories.
Yeah, first of all, you are a magician. Not only are you a man of 1,000 voices and an amazing performance that I have seen, you also have made me feel as if we're friends after an hour plus. So that's
well, but
a
that's the thing that I realized just after the first day of my first research trip, that Christy Mathewson suddenly became my friend. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until that event for Saber in 1987. So my recollection is somebody from the Hall of Fame was there, or it might have been the Saber people. So, you know, I see you coach at Santa Monica High, you played at UCLA, you're in pretty good shape. And I can recall saying, well, you know, I mean, what, like throwing 2 hours of batting practice last month to my kids? Oh, it's funny you mentioned batting practice, because tomorrow night is the Cracker Jack Classic Old Timers game at RFK Stadium, and we don't have anybody to throw batting practice. How'd you like to be Christy Mathewson? I've got to just finish this story because it's amazing.
Sure.
And it's like, are you kidding me? Then this is where I got to talk to Henry Aaron. You know, I can tell my kids Henry Aaron bombed off of me. But so I go into the tunnel at RFK, and it kind of went down, and the gates were open in right field. So that grass in right field is the first thing that you saw. And I go, the guy is there at this little kiosk, and I say, Eddie Frierson. He goes, nah. Could it be under something else? I go, Christy Mathewson. He goes, oh, yeah, go on in, Mr. Mathewson. I mean, bizarre, right? And no sooner had I hit the outfield grass, but I hear with this great, I guess, South Carolinian lilt, say, hey, who are you? And running over towards me is the most magnificent physical specimen I've ever seen. It's Catfish Hunter running over at me. And it's like, oh my gosh. Catfish Hunter's running over. Say, who are you? And this was the year that he got inducted in the Hall of Fame. So he's 42 years old and in prime condition, you know, just a beast. And, you know, I said, well, you know, and I'm not going to tell him I'm an actor. I said, I coach at Santa Monica High. They want me to be Christy Mathewson for batting practice. Well, we got to get you a locker. Come with me. And he drags me down. But because he's an American League guy, he takes me into the American League locker room. And he pushes through and he goes, well, this one's empty. Joe, you don't mind if this fellow shares a locker next to you? And he sits me right down to Joe DiMaggio. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, I'm sitting here next to Mr. Coffey. And then on my left side is Bob Feller, who was my dad's boyhood idol, because he grew up in Akron, so the Indians were his team, the Guardians. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting there, and Joe is just talking. We're just having the best time just talking. He's like, well, you know, I grew up in San Francisco and doing this and blah, blah, blah. And so then I'm just waiting, because I'm not going to put on their polyester uniform. I'm waiting for my Yankee pinstripes. I'm going to get introduced as the world's greatest living Yankee, and then I'm leaving. But I'm not going to put on this American. I'm not doing it. So I'm waiting.
I think he was introduced as the world's greatest living player, wasn't
it? It might have been.
Or was that later?
It,
I think it was
it
player.
It might have
by
been.
Then.
You know, but yes. And if they got it wrong, you know, they would leave. I have liberty to tell this story now because he's passed. Bob Feller, and this is really kind of wild because in 2011, Betty Cook from Lewisburg realized that the Hall of Fame was not doing anything to celebrate the 75th anniversary of the inaugural class, right? And so she, because they were going to celebrate the 75th anniversary of the building in 1939. So she contacted all of the original families. And in Lewisburg, we hung out for a week. My kids and myself, representing the Mathewsons, hanging out with the grandkids and great-grandkids of Ty Cobb, Honus Wagner, Walter Johnson, and Babe Ruth. Surreal for the kid from Tennessee who just went out wanting to play at UCLA and being kind of a rummy once he was there. although, you know, I could get it up there pretty good. Anyway, so I'm sitting there, and here is... It changed everything. The day before was the first version of this I ever did, where it was all reverence to Christy Mathewson and all the John McGraw and all of the, you know, it was amateurish in my own mind. If people were there and they thought it was great, I appreciate you to no end, believe me. But here's Feller, and he will not get dressed. Because he was, this will get to the anniversary thing in a second. He was very proud of, shall we say, his appendage. And so he's walking around the locker room and swinging around and he's slapping people with his own self. And I can remember Joe Garcioli going, Feller, stop it. You're still doing it. Stop it. And going, oh my gosh, these guys, I don't know how old he is, 75 or whatever, but they're all little children. And Luke Appling, who had just a couple of years before become the oldest player to hit a home run over the wall, is like, hey, that glove, I had a glove like that when I was a kid and it got stolen. I think that's my glove, you know, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is Luke Appling. I mean, because these people were baseball cards. I mean, I never saw them play, you know, and kind of the saddest thing about all of it was I had a baseball and everybody in there signed it. Of course, Joe was first, and he said, you know, I won't sign a ball if the sweet spot's been taken. And he showed, this is where I sign a baseball, and, you know, and I'll just put it back in the thing if somebody else is signed there. It says, so if you're ever signing a ball, that's where you want to sign the ball. And the sad thing about it is then during the game, I spent the whole game in the National League dugout hanging out with Gaylord Perry, really kind of took me under his wing and talked to me for 2.5 hours. It was great. And wanted one of my players from Santa Monica High to come and live with him and play on his American Legion team because he'd just taken over the job at Limestone College in South Carolina. Anyway, so, but the sad thing is to this day, of those two baseballs, the only signature you can really see is Johnny Logan because he had his own pen. You know, it was one of those 19-cent Bic blue pens, and it all... So you can kind of see where Joe D is on the sweet spot, but anyway... Finishing up this story. So when Betty Cook, and I've got to get to my Joe DiMaggio, and then I'll let you go. when Betty Cook was arranging this stuff, she's calling the Hall of Fame because she needed the family's current numbers and contact information. And it just so happened that Ann Feller, for whatever reason, happened to be there. It's like, who are you talking to? What are you doing? Well, they're going to do a thing for the 75th, you know, down in Lewis. Well, I want to go. So Ann Feller was actually there with me and the other four families. Wow. I have a whole here's a blockbuster for you. People do not think or do not know that Christy Mathewson actually has a bloodline. But that's another podcast, and I need to let you in on that. Christy Jr. had a baby.
Okay.
All right, so just save that, and they're wonderful people. But like,
is this in Gabe Schechter's book?
No, it's not in any. It's not in anybody's book. But once Peggy Frary, who was Christy Jr.'s widow, had it passed because she said you need to keep this quiet until I'm gone, and then I was waiting also. Betty Cook when I was in 2019, right before the pandemic, I did the show for the last time that I did it in Lewisburg. Betty had me come, and there was a whole thing in her parlor. You know, she was the mayor for the day and all that kind of stuff. And she called me over in the corner. She says, "Eddie," I said, "Yes." "Yes, my 93-year-old girlfriend." She says, "I have to confess something to you." I said, "What?" She goes, "I lied to you." I went, "What?" She says, "I lied to you." "So what are you talking about?" "All those years ago," and I'll explain this in another podcast of when I got contacted. Okay. "When I told you, no, that's nonsense. It's absolutely not true. I lied to you." And Jane was terrified that it would come back to haunt her. So with that little bit of thing, I'll let you know. But then now here's my Joe DiMaggio story. But I got to tell Ann Feller at that week, you know, the story of her husband slapping the guys in the locker room. And she goes, "Oh, thank you for that. You know, I met Bob after baseball, so I really appreciate these stories." And she said, "You know, his idea of a good time was buying us matching tractors." So that's my Bob Feller quote. But anyway, so Joe D and I were sitting there. Everyone's getting dressed. They're going outside. It's like, I got to go and loosen up. I got to throw batting practice. and they finally bring our uniforms, and I'm putting mine on, and Joe is putting on his Yankees. And it's weird because we're literally touching elbows, and we're the only two people in the place. And getting the things on. And there came a moment where we're both sitting up, and we're turned to each other, and we're like nose to nose. And those awkward moments, especially when you're young, and you go, you don't realize you don't have to talk, right? And I'm like,
right.
You know, because it's like, you're not going to kiss the guy, but he's really close, right? it was, you know, that uncomfortable feeling, like, yes. Oh, gosh, what do I do here? And so I said, and it's interesting, Bob Costas then, later when I told him this story, says that needs to be in the file at the Hall of Fame. I said, "So Joe," because all I knew, I didn't know that there were rules. I just knew he was married to the lady, and I'm an actor. Mm-hmm. I said, so Joe, what was Marilyn really like? And oh my goodness, you know, he had just had his first pacemaker put in. And I thought, oh my gosh, I just killed Joe DiMaggio. He turned purple, was so clearly angry at me, mm-hmm. like a stupid guy. You know, if he wasn't, you know, Mr. Coffee, he would have punched me right then and there. I have no idea what I just did, right? And he finishes, you know, it was probably 45 seconds. It seemed like 4.5 hours. He's finishing tying up his shoes. He never looked at me again. He was just like, I mean, he's shaking. He was so mad. And then as he's finishing tying his shoes, there was sort of like this exhale of breath with his shoulders kind of going, huh, as if this stupid kid has no idea. Right? It was kind of thing. And he stood up. And again, he never looked at me. He stood up. Stood there still, and then kind of over his shoulder, he said, "Kid, she was more beautiful in person." And he walked away. And I went, oh my gosh. And then, you know, to find out that to anyone's knowledge that I told that story, that's the first time they could ever recall him saying anything about her to anyone. And it what a beautiful thing to say about somebody mm-hmm. that you love so much.
Well, let me throw one more at okay. you. The record in my mind is 63 years. That's how long Hal Holbrook performed
Mark Isn't that
Twain
crazy?
Tonight.
And of course, you know, and he started when he was in college just doing like a thing in a coffee shop. Yeah. And makeup and all that. I just find it remarkable that people keep asking me to do this because I've now lived 18 years longer than Christy Mathewson did. But
you're well short of Hal Holbrook.
Well, right. I know. But it's also too.
So what's the next step toward his record for you? What's the future of
Maddie? I want to get through at least the 100th anniversary of his death. But this summer. because I did it in Cambria. Then I did it up in Tehachapi for Coach Adams, years ago, right when I did it, after I did it in New York, he wanted me to do it for the UCLA baseball team. And I can still remember him after doing it that first of all, I'm on the stage at UCLA, which I hadn't been on since I was in college. He says, you know what? As long as I'm coaching here, this is a very good impersonation of Coach Adams, by the way. As long as I'm coaching here, every other year, we're going to do this. This is required viewing of every freshman incoming class. So whether they're a freshman or a sophomore, every 2 years, we're going to do this. And we did until he retired, which is just really so much fun for me that it affected him that much. And so he wanted me to do it up in Tehachapi this summer. And so that was great. And then doing it in Pennsylvania and then going up to visit my friends at the Hall of Fame at that time, Scott Mondor and others. There suddenly was buzz, and there is now talk again of having a revival of taking it back to New York for a limited run as sort of an anniversary thing now that it's been all these years. And at some point I have to retire the show. I don't want to. I'll keep doing it as long as I can walk. But at some point, well, it's funny. Kerrigan said, I said this to him back when. I said, at some point, are they going to be saying, who's the old guy pretending to be Christy Mathewson? And his retort was, you can get old in heaven. It's like, okay, whatever. Real quick, going back to the batting practice, because again, we've got hours more of stories if you want them down the road. But here I am. I get out there, and I haven't had a chance to loosen up. First guy to stand in is Bill Mazeroski, right? And he's like this gigantic man. You know, he's probably 300 pounds. He stands up there, and my first pitch knocks him down. And you've never heard someone cuss so hard in your life. He was so mad. And Catfish is like, come on, Bill. Hey, he throws strikes. He just hadn't had a chance to loosen up. Get on in there. It's going to be all strikes. Boom, 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 boom. Okay, so we get through several batters, and then Catfish, Jim, my close personal friend Jim, says, hey, you know what? I'm going to take some swings, and then I want to throw bat at BP. If you don't mind, I'll take over for you after I hit. I've never seen anything like it. If any of the Sabre people were there, it was remarkable. He stands in and he goes, hey, Eddie, can you put it like out here about mid-thigh on the outside? I said, I'll do my best. And he goes, Madonna stage, right center field. Boom. Clank. He goes, dead center field. Boom. He says, now bring it in a little bit and up. I'm going upper deck, left-hand side. Boom, sure enough. And the upper deck wasn't that far at RFK, right? And then I swear to you, put it down here, down in, as close as you can get to like right here on the inside part of my knee. And he goes, left field foul pole. He only took four swings. Boom. And you're like thinking, well, gosh, that's awfully close. That's kind of fun. You know, even just being close is fun. Clank. And then he throws his bat and he goes, can you believe they invented the DH when there's people like me could hit? And all the players, I guess they all knew he could hit. And they're laughing. And then the sad thing was shortly after that, he was diagnosed with ALS. And it allowed me, you know, when you're so far away from stuff and people are baseball cards and you forget the human side of them, you know, right. Remembering what a stud he was. And then thinking, you know, 5 years later, he's gone, that must have been what it was like for the people who knew Lou Gehrig. Like, how can this physical specimen just wither away? And
Christy Mathewson.
Yeah, all of it, just very, very, very sad. And, you know, and if it was a different time, they, you know, Christy would have lived a lot longer, and he had so much more to offer the world and the Boston Braves in particular.
Eddie, this is officially our longest episode ever. I enjoyed every single minute. Thank you so much.
I love that. It's just another record for Christy Mathewson.
Well, I honestly don't say this all that often, even when I am thinking it, but I really hope we can stay in touch.
Oh, yeah.
I'm also hoping that I've been looking for quite a while now for a good excuse to visit New York for the first time in a long time, and I hope if you're there.
Oh,
hey
there, and just speaking of, because just yesterday I got asked to do it again at the Santa Monica Playhouse. So if anyone is in the Los Angeles area, February 23rd, 4th, and 5th, those are the dates that we're talking about doing it, and I'm going to do my best to see if we can make it even free admission for Sabre members or something like that, because it's just so much fun for me to do.
Well, my wife's been trying to get me to go down to LA with her recently, so maybe that's another. Maybe I'll see you in both
places. Why not? And then you can know where I messed up or not.
Eddie, thanks again. This has just been so much fun.
Such a blast. Thank you so much. Just pitching in a pinch.
Well, thanks again to Eddie for joining us. Listening back to that interview a few days after the fact, I enjoyed it all over again. So it's just what a pleasure. I wanted to mention a couple of things that I have been reading lately. There is a tremendous essay at a website, Threads of Our Game, about 19th century. Well, the website is devoted to 19th century baseball uniforms. This particular essay is just a great photo analysis, an image of, as it turns out, the 1897 Page Fence Giants, one of the great black baseball teams of the 19th century. And it's just a great piece of detective work. I think I don't know who listens to this show. A lot of people listening to this show will really enjoy that work. I know I never get tired of seeing photos analyzed and identified, dates locked down, people, all those sorts of things. So just that's a lot of fun. Wanted to also mention a book I started, The Wingmen, The Unlikely, Unusual, Unbreakable Friendship Between John Glenn and Ted Williams. Now, I will admit, I think maybe I was maxed out on Ted Williams books, having read, I don't know how many of them. I have pretty much all of them and have read most of them over the years. And I was planning to skip this one, but then the news came last week that The Wingmen had been nominated for the Casey Award. More on that in a minute. And a day or two later, I was in my local library, and there was The Wingmen. And I thought, this must be a sign. They don't get many baseball books at my library, so I should probably pick this one up. And I did pick it up, and I started reading it. By the way, the author is Adam Lazarus, and it's really well written. The first, I don't know, third of the book basically takes place during the Korean War. My only reservation is that the bombing is trivialized, and I don't know that I need to get into any great detail about that. But the older I get and the more I read about war and bombing, and I've read a lot, I've been reading about that kind of stuff since I was 9 or 10 years old, the less appealing I find those stories when they don't account for the actual effects of bombing. There's just a lot of, in this one, there's just a lot of sort of abstracted passages. Oh, this suspected supply dump was destroyed, or this area was strafed, that sort of thing. Bombs were deployed, not dropped on people, equipment just deployed. So otherwise it's quite well done. It's not, these days dual biographies are quite popular, at least writing them is quite popular. And I'm not sure it always works, but in this case, I think it works because those two did have a relationship, and obviously they're both interesting people. And I've never read anything about John Glenn, so not anything significant. So the book works. I am sure I will finish it. And congratulations to Adam Lazarus for the Casey Award nomination. And speaking of which, I wanted to mention also that within the span of 11 episodes earlier this year, three other Casey Award nominees were on this show. Those authors were Ryan McGee, the author of, hold on, let me look at this list so I don't get the title wrong. Welcome to the Circus of Baseball, a story of the perfect summer at the perfect ballpark at the perfect time. Episode 221, we were joined by Russell Carlton, author of The New Ball Game, The Not So Hidden Forces Shaping Modern Baseball. And episode 227, we were joined by Steve Gitchier, who wrote probably my favorite baseball book of 2023, Baseball, The Turbulent Mid-Century Years. I recommend all of those books, obviously, if you go back and listen to those episodes. I read all three, enjoyed them, really enjoyed my conversations with all three authors. I do think that Steve Gitchier's book is a landmark in the literature, and I think I and others will return to it for many years. I think it is the definitive work of its kind covering that era or eras. Congratulations also to Joe Posnanski, who has been on this show, I believe, a couple of times. Joe's book, Why We Love Baseball, A History in 50 Moments, is not only nominated for a Casey, and I believe Joe's already won two or three of those things. It also was on the New York Times bestseller list recently. So congrats to Joe and all the other Casey Award nominees. Winners of the weekend. Well, gosh, we're down almost to the end. There will be, I believe, a couple more at least championship series games. Fortunately, neither one of these series turned into routs, which seemed like they might at the beginning of them, which is always kind of disheartening when the baseball runs out too soon. But no, they've been a very exciting series. Plenty of drama, lots of things to talk and write about, which is all you can ask for. Really, I can't say that I'm wildly excited about whichever World Series matchup we wind up with, but that's all right. You don't get to choose. There will be plenty of drama and excitement, most likely in the World Series, no matter who's playing. Which the next time we speak, we'll know all about. Thanks again to Eddie Frierson for joining us, for giving us so much of his time. And I just, can't say enough about his willingness to talk about a lot of stuff. Really enjoyed it. Thanks to Eddie. Thanks to our tremendous producer, J.W. Cox. Thanks to Jacob Pomerinke at Sabre for spreading the word about this podcast. And as always, thanks to all of you for listening. We literally would not do this without you. Take care of yourselves. Till next time.
This has been SaberCast with Rob Dyer, a production of the Society for American Baseball Research. Find even more baseball research, previous episodes of SaberCast, bonus content from this episode, and a list of what Rob's reading at saber.org. Music for SaberCast is provided by The Baseball Project.